Good evening. This is KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits and Ukiah, 88.1 FM Fort Bragg, and KZYX.org on the World Wide Web. Mendocino County Public Broadcasting, listener-supported community radio. And it's just 6:58 and 55 seconds, and we're getting ready for education now. So we'll just start up with the music, and then I'll be back, and we'll get started with our guests. So hold on, and here we go with the music.
You, who are on the road, must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by. Them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by.
Well, good evening. This is Athena Melville, your host for Education Now. And tonight it brings me great pleasure to introduce Sonoma State University Professor Kathy Morris, who is my guest tonight on Education Now. Professor Morris teaches and coordinates the mathematics teaching methods courses, supervises student teachers, teaches graduate courses, coordinates Sonoma State University's program to support their graduate students to achieve National Board for Professional Teaching Standards certification, and she is the director of Sonoma State University's Satellite Elementary Teacher Credential Program in Ukiah. Kathy taught elementary school for 5 years, worked doing professional development for elementary mathematics, primarily through the Western U.S. for 4 years, including a bit of international work with the Department of Defense Dependent Schools. She did her doctoral work at the University of Michigan with some of the top mathematics educators in the country. She has been at Sonoma State University for 5 years and was just granted tenure and promoted to associate professor as of August 2008. Her research interests include studying mathematics classroom discourse that promotes high levels of participation and rigorous mathematical work, as well as studying elementary teachers' opportunities to learn through professional development. I call Professor Kathy Morris the Grand Mage of Teachers, because when I told people that she was going to be on the show, and if they had had her as a teacher, they were just so overwhelmed and excited. And so I want to introduce her to you now. Hello, Kathy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. I'll speak directly into your mic.
Okay.
There we go. That's good. And I just welcome you so much, Kathy. I thank you for taking the time and coming into the studio to speak to us. That really, it's really helpful. And so let's get started, if that's okay?
Absolutely.
All right. So let's get started with the first question. Why do so many people think that they are not good at math?
I think, unfortunately, it starts young. It's perception about what mathematics is. In our elementary schools, we privilege arithmetic. We privilege computation and privilege...
Kathy, we need to start again because the button wasn't pushed. So once again, say hello to everyone.
Good evening.
So we're asking Kathy the question, why do so many people think that they are not good at math?
So as I was saying, I think it starts, unfortunately, very young for a number of students. And one of the main reasons is that we treat the whole field of mathematics as if it were about computation and arithmetic, and as if that were all that there were to it. we ask children very young to start memorizing, and we use memorization often as a gatekeeper. We tell children, you need to know these facts, you need to memorize these procedures, and we take away a lot of the creativity, the interdisciplinarity of mathematics. We rob children of their opportunities to draw on their own prior knowledge and their sense of the world.
Yes. Yes, yes. Totally agree. Okay, so now, why do so many of your students seem to discover that they are good at math?
Well, I think one of the things that I try to help my students see, and my students, to be clear, are people preparing to be elementary teachers primarily at this point, and to some extent people who are already practicing as elementary and middle school teachers, occasionally high school teachers. I think one of the things that I help people do is reframe their self-image and their sense of their capacity and efficacy in mathematics. And some of the teaching techniques that I share with my students, I demonstrate on them, I model with them, so that they can learn how to help their own students overcome fear and anxiety in mathematics. So I help students do things like think back to their own elementary school days or middle school days. And for many, many students, there's a certain point at which they hit a wall. They feel, whether it's in sixth grade or just going into middle school, that they're no longer able to keep up, or algebra or geometry or calculus. At certain road marks on the way, people realize, oh wait, I haven't memorized enough, I don't know these procedures. And I try to help students learn to draw on their prior knowledge. One of the things we try to debunk is that speed, being fast at mathematics, is the same as being good at mathematics. If you think back to third grade, probably most of us can remember who it was that was raising their hand, me, call on me. And if it wasn't you, you started to feel like you couldn't do it. So helping to debunk the myth of speed equaling being good is one of the main things we do. We slow things down. We try to talk about strategies. We have conversations about mathematics to help people understand and draw upon what they know.
All right. So why is it important for students to understand and not just memorize?
A math educator named Robert Wirtz had a quote.
Robert Wirtz?
Wirtz had a quote that goes something like, the child who is asked to memorize and made dependent upon their memory is fragile. That if they think they know, they're never sure. And we don't want our children to be fragile in their mathematics. We want children to be solid. And so one of the pieces that I work with future teachers and current teachers with is to understand not that memorization isn't helpful, but that it's only one piece of what's important. If you think about multiplication tables, for example, and talk with, go to the supermarket and just randomly ask people multiplication facts. I've done this, probably most people wouldn't. You'll find that there are lots of thriving, successful adults out there who don't know off the top of their head, automatic recall, all of their multiplication facts. And yet they're able to survive and thrive. And we treat these facts, though, as if that was exactly what you needed in order to be able to be a successful adult, in order to be able to go on mathematics. Really what we need is for students to be fluent, to be able to get the answer within a reasonable period of time. One of the problems lots and lots of students struggle with is knowing which one is which, 9 times 6 or 7 times 8. One of them's 56, one of them's 54, I don't know which one, I can't remember, I'm stuck, what do I do? Well, if all we ask of kids is to memorize these random bits of isolated information, they aren't going to be able to solve those quandaries when they get to that point and they're not sure which is which. They'll freeze. On the other hand, if we help kids tap into their prior knowledge, what they know about mathematics, it becomes a very easy, natural task. Well, I can't remember 9 times 6, but I know 10 times 6. 10 times 6 is 60. Well, this is 6 less. That one must be the 54. I don't know 8 times 7, but every kid in the Bay Area, greater Bay Area, knows 7 times 7 is 49 because we've got the 49ers. I don't know 7 times 8. I don't know 8 times 7, but I know 7 times 7, and that's just got to be one more 7. That's the 56. And right. By tapping into the pieces that we do know, kids are able to access so much more, and rather than feeling like a not knower of mathematics, like they're dumb at mathematics because they can't remember the facts, they realize that they're powerful, that they can be a problem solver. The difference between automaticity and fluency might be just the matter of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 seconds. And yet that's all the difference in the world in terms of student self-esteem, student sense of power.
Right. I have said before that memorization, that's arithmetic, but the problem solving and understanding, that's mm-hmm. mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
But so how do materials and math dialogues affect the teaching of math today?
Well, there are a lot of materials that are really useful in the math classroom. And some of them are commercially made materials that we call manipulatives in the field. Those are materials that have been constructed with particular mathematical properties. Things like geoboards that are basically wooden boards with nails or pegs in them to help visualize geometric figures. Or base 10 blocks, which are numerical
yes.
cubes and rods that help students understand our place value system. Pattern blocks that help students understand a myriad of things from angle measurement to counting to perimeter. There also are not commercially available materials that are just as helpful. Things like a whole tray full of buttons that little kids can sort and get their hands on. Clay and Play-Doh to model, and also just pen and pencil and crayons that can help students make drawings that are a form of mathematical representations.
Right.
All of those things are wisely used by the teacher in classroom to help children accomplish various kinds of mathematical goals, tasks.
And concepts. Yes, I know one of the things that I love about a Montessori classroom is that there is a geometry basket
mm-hmm.
with all the geometric solids, and then there are the planes, mm-hmm. the geometric planes, and so that you're getting a hands-on experience with those materials, and then the trinomial cube, you
mm-hmm.
know, it's so exciting when I had a child come into the classroom. She was very good at math anyway. I think I told you about her. And she just took a look at the powers of 10 that you were talking about. And she just was like, aha. You know, it all made sense to her. It was really wonderful. And do kids get to use these materials, do you think, in most classrooms today?
I think one of the things that unfortunately is happening, and perhaps in part as a result of No Child Left Behind and some of the accountability trends that are going on, is that students are having less and less time, certainly for free exploration of these kinds of materials. And that's part of it, is developing their own sense, their own curiosity, their own inquiries about these materials. And we're seeing less and less of that. In the past, that's always been the purview of early childhood education, preschool, kindergarten, first, maybe second grade. And we're seeing a move away from that currently in early childhood education.
Oh, my dear.
Which breaks my heart.
Oh,
children
my.
Need informal experiences. They also need formal experiences, more didactic, more instructional experiences using these materials, because mathematical materials are actually what mathematicians use. They
yes.
build models. They use tools. They make drawings, graphs. Mathematicians do not sit in a desk, in a row, doing sheets and sheets of problems. That's not authentic to the discipline. And so one of the things that is currently going on in school is a push towards more and more use of standardized worksheet practice pages. And it's not the direction that I think is appropriate for schooling. I think children need their hands on things. There's a time and place for practice, but the best time for practice is once you're working and you're developing some ideas, and you need to move those ideas from sort of fragile to more solid. That's the appropriate time for practice. And what we're seeing in classrooms right now is that practice is what's going on all the time.
All the time.
Instead
all
of
the time.
Doing and exploring and building, both in the realm of arithmetic, which is certainly part of mathematics, but also geometry, algebra, statistics. There's such a need for understanding data and statistics in today's world. We're bombarded with numbers.
Right.
We need to understand them.
Yes. Yes, yes. Okay, what about standard algorithms?
So a standard algorithm...
Should we be teaching them?
Mm-hmm, a standard algorithm is the... it's not the law, but it's the way that most people in the U.S. have adopted to do a multiplication problem or to do an addition or subtraction problem. So if you think about a problem 15 times 18, your teacher taught you, and you can probably hear in your head, 15 times 18. Well, 8 times, you'd write it vertically. 8 times 5 is 40. Put down the 0, carry the 4. 8 times 1 is 8, plus the 4 is 12. And then you'd write that 12. And there's a rote pattern to the way that most of us were taught to do formulas. And there's nothing wrong with them. They're very important, and it's important that children have access to them because it's cultural capital. One of the things that I believe, though, is that those aren't necessarily the first or the only way. In fact, many countries use different algorithms than our own, some of which I think are even more efficient than ours. But also there are intuitive ways that children can solve problems. So, for example, maybe I can ask the audience a multiplication problem and they can think about it, and then I can share a number of different ways that it could be solved to help them understand non-standard algorithm, right? So pose the problem 9 times 24, and we can imagine how you would set it up formally, but I want to give the audience a couple seconds to think about how else it could be solved. Now, in my classroom, I'd give a lot of what's called wait time. That's the important time when people can ponder a problem and kind of chew on it before somebody else raises their hand or shouts out the answer. I don't know how much wait time to give on the radio, so I'll give a couple of answers, a couple of different what I'd call solution paths to this problem. 9 times 24. What do we know about 9 times 24? Well, we know about tens. We know about 25s. We know half of 24 is 12. All of those things can be leverage points for solving this problem in a non-standard way. 9 times 24. Well, I know 10 times 24 would be 240. But that's 24 too many. I take that away. I can do that in my head. Take away the 20. That'd be 220. And take away the 4 more. I could even count back on my fingers and get to 216. That's one possibility.
Yes.
But I used to have a live in an apartment where we had a laundry machine downstairs, and I always had to have quarters for that machine. So I know about quarters as well. I know that 9 quarters is $2.25 because I had to do the laundry. So I can imagine now that I have 25 cents, 9 times, $2.25. Well, but that's 9 cents too many, so it's really... $2.16, but this wasn't a money problem, so it's 216. I also know, well, I as a kid I had to memorize 9 times 12. 9 times 12 is 108, but I've got two of those because I've got 9 times 24. 108 and 108, 216.
Yeah, all that's the way I do it.
All of those ways that feel kind of intuitive, and some of us, if we have those ways in our mind, feel like maybe we're cheating if we didn't do it the way our teacher told us.
Oh, yeah, just when you mentioned fingers, I mean, I don't know how many people just would just die if you if they see you using your fingers.
Right, but what a great tool. We carry it around with us all the time. I use all those tools, right? I still count on my fingers. So we have these informal ways. They actually lead to children developing the distributive property. That's a huge thing they need to learn when they get to algebra. If we allow children an opportunity to solve problems in ways that make sense to them, they develop tools that serve later on in life. This reasoning, commutative and associative property, and distributive property, they develop these intuitively.
So you're talking about their problem solving, and they're using critical thinking skills.
Absolutely.
In what you're describing.
And drawing upon prior knowledge, knowing that there are things that they do know that they can leverage to get to something that they want to know. Once kids have that, then it's an easy leap to teach them the standard algorithm, which is something that we all share if we grew up in the United States. We share some fairly similar standard algorithms as a way of communicating, as shortcuts.
So you've really answered what the advantages are to a non-standard algorithm, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what is the connection between teaching math and just good teaching practices?
I think one of the things about good teaching of mathematics is that you have to listen to your students. You have to be able to hear your students, to understand, to tease out what they know and be interested in what they're thinking, and I think that's just plain good teaching. You have to be able to instill in students an appreciation of the subject, a sense of efficacy in what they're doing, a sense that they can learn, that they're capable, even if it's hard, developing a sense of perseverance, cultivating what the National Research Council calls positive dispositions. And I think that that is a really important piece that translates into all good teaching. A sense of being a lifelong learner and curious about the world out there.
Yes, a lifelong learner. And so if you're a teacher who's listening, or a parent who is homeschooling, and you think you don't like math, well, listen up, everybody.
It's a real problem. This is actually a national, I would say, a national quandary we're stuck in. You know, I use the analogy of nobody would ever walk into a restaurant and sit down with all of their friends and have most of the women and many of the men say, "I can't read the menu. Can somebody help me read the menu? I never liked reading when I was in school. I was never very good at it." And yet, when the bill comes, that's exactly what happens with math. Many of the women, it's more common in women, although not, there's certainly a number of women who feel very powerful, and less common with men, although I encounter a huge number of men who are also uncomfortable with mathematics. If it were reading, we would never announce it to the world. However, we wear our innumeracy, like illiteracy, but with numbers, we wear our innumeracy like a badge of honor. I was never good at math. I can't even balance my checkbook. Here, help me figure out the tip for the bill. I don't know how to do that 15% thing. And this has real implications, I think, for our students. As parents, if we say to our kids, "Oh, it's okay, honey. I was never good at math either," or, you know, things like that, our children look at us as successful adults and figure, "Well, my parents are fabulous people. My teacher's a fabulous person. They didn't like math. They weren't good at math. I guess it's okay if I don't like math and I'm not good at math." And so this gets perpetuated year after year. And so somehow, if somebody wasn't good at reading or didn't like reading, they hide that. That's something that we're not proud of. And yet, we're proud. We're comfortable announcing we don't like math. And I think we're injuring our children by doing so.
Yeah,
I think we're sending the wrong message.
I agree. I agree with you. Now, how about the issue of creativity? the issue of creativity is something that people don't necessarily connect with math.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk about creativity in math?
Absolutely. I think math is such a creative subject, and you know, I want to set this up to say I'm not talking about the pages and pages of worksheets. That's a misperception of what math is. So
yes.
When I'm talking about creativity, I'm talking about things like a sixth grade class as the first week of school project. The teacher introduces all the kids to each other, and for the first week, they work on building an average sixth grader. Well, what's an average sixth grader? Well, we have to look around our class and see, do we have brown hair or blonde hair or red hair or black hair? Do we have blue eyes or green eyes or hazel eyes or brown eyes or black eyes? How tall are we? How long is our hair? What's the circumference around our head? We have to collect all of this data and then use that to figure out, well, what is the average circumference of the sixth grade head in our class? And then once we've got all of these important pieces, our arm length, the size of our shoe, the color shirt we like to wear, we figure out all of that, we have to build it with paper mache. And we have to actually make a life-size model of our average sixth grader. That's creativity in mathematics.
Yes, that is. That is beautifully creative. Well, how do you feel about games like where you're looking for patterns
mm-hmm.
and using a matrix? I know that I would let children use a matrix, a multiplication matrix,
mm-hmm.
to do math problems.
Sure.
Because then they see all those patterns, and and they also, you know, then you can point out things like what 4 squared is and
absolutely.
6.
Absolutely.
You know, and so, and I don't see that as much as I would like to in the system.
Well, embedded in what you've said are a number of really important things. The first is that math should be fun, and there are a number of math games. I think one of the reasons as an adult I like math is because as a child I played games. Played games with my family. We played dominoes. We played gin rummy. We played chutes and ladder. We played Monopoly. We played Sorry. At a certain
yes.
point, playing some of those games, I started to want to be the banker.
Yeah.
I needed to be the one who kept score. But all of those games reinforced in a very low stress, low anxiety, collegial way, certain things about math. And so I think that playing games and being playful with numbers and patterns is fantastic. It's great for all children. And in fact, when I was mentioning earlier about facts, I think that one of the low-stress ways that people can learn facts is by playing games. But another thing that you mentioned had to do with seeing relationships, and that is fundamental to mathematics. To
right.
the discipline of mathematics and things that help bridge different aspects, what we call strands of mathematics, bridging geometry and number. You mentioned square numbers. It's high school often before somebody knows, and sometimes not even then, that the reason we call a squared number is because geometrically you can represent a square with it. In fact, that's what anybody who does building or construction does for a living, they measure things. We
yeah.
measure rectangular spaces. Well, if you say, I have a 2x4, you're talking about 2x4 inches.
Right.
And that a square, a 4x4, is a square that is 4x4, and it has an area of 16.
Right. Well, we're getting into that area of visualization.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that one of the reasons that I love the concrete is because if a child can't visualize in their mind, if they can't see the square
mm-hmm.
versus the cube, if they can't see the sphere or the circle, they, you know, those concrete materials really help them along until they get to that point, because once you can visualize,
mm-hmm.
that is when, well, we would say you move from the concrete to the abstract.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to, it's 7:28 here, and we're going to take a little break. Do you want to talk some more about visualization before we do?
I could get us started, and then maybe that'd be something we'd finish up afterwards.
Great.
So visualization is fundamental to mathematics, and the Jean Piaget, a educational scholar, philosopher, psychologist, talks a lot about children moving from concrete to abstract ways of understanding their world. And one of the things that's interesting and important and part of why I love mathematics is as we move from concrete to abstract, it's not that we lose the concrete or lose the representational. What we're doing is we're developing a larger repertoire of things that help us understand our world and talk about and represent our world. And so in mathematics, it's important that children of all ages have opportunities to experience things by manipulating models and tools, by making sketches, representations, and by symbolic, more abstract ways of representing their world.
Notations,
yes,
yeah. All right, well, on that note, we're going to take a little music break here. And what I've selected, with Kathy's approval, is from The Muppets, Can You Picture That? Visualizing, right? Can You Picture That? So here we go with a little music break. And...
rainbows in. I never think of money, I think of milk and honey, grinning like a Cheshire cat. I focus on the pleasure, something I can treasure. Can you picture that? Can you picture that? Oh yeah! Hey Floyd, take a verse.
Let me take your picture, add it to the mixture. Aaron is a gotcha now. Really nothing to it, anyone can do it. It's easy and we all know how. Now begins a changing, mental rearranging. Nothing's really where it's at.
Down the Eiffel Tower's holding up a flower. I gave it to a Texas cat.
Fact is there's nothing out there you can't do. Yeah, even Santa Claus believes in you. Be an up and comer. Can you picture that?
Guys, back, yeah.
All of us are winning, picking and a grinning. Lordy, but I love to jam.
Jelly belly giggling, dancing and a winking. Honey, that's the way I am.
I lost my heart in Texas, Northern Lights of Texas. I keep it underneath my hat.
Well, there you have it. Can you picture that? And we're going to continue talking now, finish up a little conversation about visualization, and we will be opening the lines if you'd like to ask Kathy any questions. The number here in the studio is 895-2448. If you're in the 707 area code, that's 895-2448. Or out of the 707 area code is 1-800-499-7117. So those are the numbers. So Kathy, let's go on now. Talk some more about visualization.
Well, I think visualization is important for a number of reasons. First, in general, it helps children connect mathematics to the world around them. It helps them learn about properties of geometry, shapes, angles, curves. But it also helps them with computation and solving algebraic problems and understanding the relationship between these elements of mathematics. And so there are a number of, you know, sorts of problems that a parent or a teacher could introduce to various children that children of various ages that could help them with various elements of geometry or visualizing computation problems. A problem that I love, that it's not a geometric problem, but one could visualize, one could make sketches of, is the kinds of problems that I call the chicken and pig problems. So imagine you're a farmer, you have chickens and pigs, and you look out in your barnyard and you see 22 legs. Well, how many animals do you have? Right? This is a question that a child could start to visualize. They can imagine it, they can sketch, they can make quick sketches, not elaborate sketches, but right. quick sketches, and come up with multiple solutions to this problem. Right. And in fact, it's the kind of problem that a six-year-old would be intrigued with.
Right.
But it's also the kind of problem that a sixth grader or an eighth grader or a tenth grader would be intrigued with, because it's actually algebra.
And it's fun.
And it's fun.
Someone's calling us on line three, so let's go ahead and take that call. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Good evening. What a great program. I am calling because I have a couple of questions. Well, first I want to give you a little background. I'm one of those people who she was talking about, younger, who got discouraged in mathematics really young. And I won't say that it made my life harder. I'll say that. I'm blessed at this point in my life to have married someone with a PhD in mathematics education. And when we were dating, he was writing for the Math Learning Center, the Bridges program for lower mm-hmm. grades. And mm-hmm. I was his test guinea pig, along with his fourth grade and third grade daughter. And I was so, I'm just so happy for our kids today, because they have opportunities now that we didn't have. Mm-hmm. So I'm thrilled. The question I have, though, is that we're seeing teaching to the test, especially in California,
mm-hmm.
and I would be interested to know what the doctor would say about, as we get lower and lower and lower grades of starting these kids on this testing, and I guess that would be my concern, is not encouraging, California doesn't encourage teachers to use these manipulatives or do all these things. Some of this stuff is very dry that we're giving our kids, and I'd just like to hear her comments on that.
Well, thank you. And
thank
would you want to listen to the answer on the air?
I certainly will.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, congratulations on overcoming some of your math anxiety, and from what I know of the Bridges program, it's a really quality program. You know, I'm really happy to address the testing issue. I think
it's interesting because that was the next question
I had
for you.
It was, in fact. It's something I worry tremendously about. And since I just gave the chicken and pig problem, let me tell you my story about cows. Let's take the analogy of, rather than teachers and students, farmers and cows. And, you know, if you're a farmer and you have cows, the fact is, if your cows are starting to be underweight, or you look out in the field and you see that your cows are underweight, you know. And by analogy, I'm talking about teachers who look out and see that some of their students aren't thriving, or maybe their school isn't thriving. What our national approach, and in California, what our approach has been over the last 8 years or 10 years to deal with these farmers who have cows that aren't thriving, has been to go and get bigger and better scales and find more and better ways of measuring our cows. And precise, you know, is it an ounce? Is it a half an ounce? What if we could get that cow to just weigh a little bit more? And we're putting tremendous energy and effort into weighing and measuring our cows. And really what we ought to be doing is talking to the farmers who know they have underweight cows, who know their cows are too skinny, and we should be helping them to have more and better nutritional food and helping the farmers learn better ways of delivering that food to their cows. So using that as an analogy for what's going on in our schools, we're seeing that our schools are spending more and more money and time and energy measuring students. Measuring, can they do this? Can they do that? What date have they been able to achieve this? We're measuring, we're getting better and better ways of measuring what they're doing. What we're not doing is investing in better and better curriculum and better preparation and training for our teachers to be able to deliver that high, meaty, robust curriculum to our students, curriculum that involves more than just computation, more than just memorization. The fact is, if we teach kids to compute and to memorize, it's easy and cheap to measure. It doesn't mean it's the best food, the best nutrition, the best nourishment, you know, by analogy for our students.
Right. I just totally agree with you. Well, what special things do you have to share with us that you before I ask you any more questions? Mm-hmm. I mean, there are things that you feel it really important to get out to people, teachers and parents, that I know that, you know, for me, I really enjoy using things that have a matrix attached, like the mm-hmm. game Othello, mm-hmm. where and the game and the Pente and chess,
mm-hmm.
and I just feel like kids love them so much, and they're learning so much that you can't really measure on those fill-in-the-bubble tests.
Well, I think one of the things that all of those examples have in common is strategic thinking. And strategic thinking is actually one of the things, I mentioned the National Council Research Council earlier.
Yes.
In 2001, they came out with a report called Adding It Up. And it's a national report by a panel of top mathematicians and math educators. And one of the things that they said is that there actually are five interwoven elements of mathematics that are fundamental for our students to be successful. And one of them is procedural fluency. We work on that a lot in U.S. schools. It's not something to be overly concerned about. We spend a tremendous amount of time working on that. But they also talked a lot about adaptive and flexible reasoning and strategic competence. Those are the sorts of things that are developed by the games that you've mentioned. We don't spend enough time in schools worrying about those things and working to help kids develop that. We also don't spend enough time really delving into conceptual development. Why are we doing this? What does it mean when we do this? How does it connect to the next things that we're going to be doing as we move through the grades? And we don't spend enough time really supporting students to develop those productive dispositions of perseverance, a sense of efficacy, flexibility, the ability to be wrong and to use that as a stepping stone to learning something new.
Right.
You know?
That it's not getting the right answer.
No.
That's so frustrating, especially with these tests, because if you give a person the opportunity to rationalize and they can tell you why they gave that answer,
mm-hmm.
many times it just makes sense.
Absolutely.
And that's something else you just can't see on a test.
No.
And on these bubble tests.
The capacity to communicate and articulate one's thinking is something that I would really advocate, whether it's a parent working with a child or in a classroom. We need to spend time and find time for students to talk about their understanding, and so that it isn't just the teacher who does the talking,
right,
or the parent who does the explaining when we're talking about math, but
peer
students.
Teaching would really be helpful mm-hmm. in that way, wouldn't it, too?
Absolutely.
I know I use a lot of that in my private school,
mm-hmm.
a lot of peer teaching, and I would hope that they would. It must be more difficult when you have all the same age group.
Sure, sure. But it doesn't need to be peer teaching. It also can just be conversations about mathematical ideas where kids
yes.
are throwing out ideas. You know, you don't need to know the answer to have an idea about what you think is going to happen or why you might try this approach first or why something didn't work. And so having venues for conversations, whether it's a whole class conversation or opportunities for kids to talk in pairs.
We've got people calling.
Oh, good.
Shall we take these?
Absolutely.
Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. This may be a little bit off topic, but I come across a lot of children who have gone past the ages, like they're in 6th and 7th grade, and they still haven't had the manipulative and the conceptual experiences. And do we have any resources in Mendocino County that the doctor is speaking of?
Okay, thank you. We'll try to answer that question.
Thank you.
I don't know specifically about resources in Mendocino County that would specifically remediate, but I want to be clear and say it's not too late. It's never too late for a student or an adult, you know, to develop the underlying concepts. And what it takes is time and patience and tasks that are actually really going to be engaging and making those connections to the things that the child already knows, whether it's making connections between fractions work that goes on in a classroom and cooking or building or sewing, things that children are doing at home with their families, helping make those connections between, well, what if we have a recipe where we're working with 2/3 of a tablespoon, and how would I double the recipe? How would I triple the recipe? Can help children develop these understandings over time.
Yeah, cooking is a great way.
Absolutely.
To introduce. And I also, I've had teachers, oh, here we have another call. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Hello, Athena.
Hello.
Hello, Kathy.
Hi.
Good program.
Thank you.
In efforts to raise the standardized test scores, some of the districts are requiring teachers to do a very narrow focus of instruction just on their grade levels of standards. And this doesn't allow for any kind of remediation. What kind of impact would you see from this kind of a discrete focus on grade level standards?
Unfortunately, I think it's a fairly misguided attempt to deal with a real problem. There is a real issue in California schools with children who are falling behind. That's real. But the problem with a narrow focus like that is it's sort of as if you said everybody's going to be 5'9" by grade 8, or you said everybody is going to be able to run a 100-yard dash. I don't know what an appropriate time would be for that. Let's say a mile in 4 minutes by the time they're graduating high school. We can't assume that every child is going to have the exact same developmental trajectory. That doesn't mean that every child isn't going to be able and ready to learn, but it's silly to think that every child learns exactly in the same order or sequence. And it's another tragedy with this sort of over-regulation or over-scrutiny of what goes on in the classroom. It doesn't enable a teacher to address the children who are actually sitting in their room.
Yeah,
find their needs.
Instead of like this, as if there is such a thing as the average.
Right.
I love this analogy that Carl Jung used when he was talking about statistics. He said they'll tell you that the average pebble is the size of your fingernail, the little finger. Now, you go to the beach and you try to find a pebble that size,
mm-hmm.
and you won't find one.
Right.
And that's why how ridiculous it is to keep talking about some stupid average when all of them are individuals.
Absolutely. And an implication by focusing so narrowly means that we're not doing what is authentic to mathematics. We're not connecting important ideas to related other important ideas. We're not connecting finding the area of a rectangle to multiplication. We're not connecting addition to multiplication in sensible ways because we are teachers in the communities are feeling pressure to move page by page through the book, rather than we do a couple of problems, and somebody in the room has a fabulous idea that gets shared, and we follow that
yes.
for a while because it makes sense.
Well, following the child, wow, wouldn't that be education again?
Not just following the child, but following a mathematical thought, a mathematical thread that would connect ideas, would make the teaching more coherent. One of the things that I see that when teachers are working in this sort of page-by-page, limited, focus just on my grade, notion is that sometimes mathematical misconceptions are put out there inadvertently. So, for example, it's not uncommon in a first or second or third grade classroom to hear the teacher say something like, the child is trying to subtract 12 minus 18, and the teacher looks at that and says, oh, no, you can't do that. You can't subtract 12, take away 18. You have to take the smaller number away from the bigger number. It has to be 18, take away 12. Well, what the teacher's trying to do is support the child. What inadvertently is happening is they're setting up a lot of unteaching for future grade levels when they get to negative numbers and the child does actually need to take 18 away from 12 and end up with negative 6. There are a number of things that are inadvertently set into motion by having a very narrow, prescriptive sense of what must be covered.
Right. Well, it's getting to that time, and so I want you to be sure that we have covered just all the little gems that you have. I know Paul had asked me, I wanted to say, can teachers really apply best practices under No Child Left Behind?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and what do you see as the greatest problems? What do you see as the greatest strengths? I think you've covered most of that. I mean, I know funding, mm-hmm. funding, right?
Yeah, and funding that's appropriate. Funding that really supports teachers to learn. I don't necessarily love the term best practices because I think that implies that there is a way. And I don't feel like there's a way.
Yes.
I think they're good practices. And I think what we want teachers to be doing is to follow good practices, to be able to ask authentic questions. The best questions you can ask your students and parents are, what do you think? How do you know? Is there another way to do it? Move towards opening kids' eyes up to multiplicity, to think that there's more than one way to solve a problem, that there always will be more than one way to solve a problem, that you should be using what you know to get to what you want to know. And I think it's important for us it's not that there's not some awful stuff going on in educational policy and some things that we want to really fight against. That's true. But I think it's important that we remember the creativity and the curiosity that children bring to school, and remember that our job is to keep that curiosity, the creativity, the inquisitiveness, the interest in the world around them open, and that kids, if we follow kids' leads, they'll help us do that.
And to me, that's what best practice is,
mm-hmm.
is that you're following the child's lead.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I don't know how teachers, I mean, we had Margot Porter on, and I mean, she's amazing
mm-hmm.
that she does that
mm-hmm.
in this system.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there are other remarkable people who, under it all,
mm-hmm.
manage to do it, so I know that it must be possible. But when I think of how much better it could be for the teachers and the students if they got the kind of support,
mm-hmm.
you know, that they really needed.
Sure.
Is there anything you feel that our listeners could do to help give more support to teachers and to, you know, that?
I think talking to school administrators and school boards and letting them know that there's a time and a place for practicing mathematics, but it isn't the be-all and end-all. It isn't the entirety of the subject or the discipline. That we have to help them understand that what we want for our children is an opportunity to have math and art integrated and math and science integrated. Math and PE, go out and play PE and take the statistics of the basketball game or the track and field events and come back and crunch those numbers and play around with that. That we want opportunities for mathematics to be back and in play with children's lives, not just on pages of endless pages of worksheets.
Yes, yes. Couldn't agree with you more. Well, we need to say goodbye to Kathy so that I can do housekeeping. But Kathy, thank you so much.
And thank you for having me.
Oh, it was just so fun, and it just went too fast. And Kathy's given permission to give her contact information. So if you want to get a hold of Kathy, you can email her at morrisk, that's M-O-R-R-I-S-K, at sonoma.edu. So thank you once again, Kathy.
Thank you.
And, the time is flying here. It's 7:54. So let's see. There are lots of things that I wanted to tell you. First of all, I want to tell you about a play that is happening in Mendocino. It's called Gross Indecency, The Three Trials of Oscar Wilde. Moses Kaufman, author of the Laramie Project, is the brilliant play about art, morality, gender, and class. A must-see for Oscar Wilde fans. Directed by Ann Woodhead, who also used to teach at Sonoma State University. June 12th through July 20th, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at 8 p.m., Sundays at 2 p.m. One thing I heard about this play is that there are lots of different ages in it. So it's there are older people, there are young people, there are middle-aged people, and I thought that was wonderful to hear. I also wanted to tell you that The Great Spout presents Tambourine Shorty and Orleans Avenue, a benefit concert for Tree of Life School, Sunday, July 20th at the Ukiah Brewing Company, starting at 8 p.m. And I wanted to tell you that. Now I want to give Amy Goodman, I want to give you a little something from Amy Goodman, and then I want to tell all of you teachers that if you use Amy Goodman in the classroom, that you should contact education@democracynow.org. I know I did, and that is certainly what I did. So we're gonna listen to this now.
We must take the battle to the enemy.
The administration is very proud of the precision with which they went about yesterday's attack.
There have been apparently very few casualties, which is exactly what the United States government wanted.
This all has to be challenged. Our mission is to make dissent commonplace in America. Dissent is what makes this country healthy. And the media has to fight for that, and we have to fight for an independent media.
We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never preview.
Democracy Now! Each weekday morning at 8 on KZYX and Z.
District of the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it.
So I hope you enjoyed that. And once again, if you're using Democracy Now! In the classroom, please connect with education@democracynow.org. Now I want to give you a little something else here that's happening, a benefit for KZYX and Z.
Just in time for the fall elections, the Tony Award-winning San Francisco Mime Troupe skewers the electoral process with their newest play, Red State. This colorful musical explores what would happen if a small town found itself at the forefront of a political battle. Red State plays Fort Bragg's Cotton Auditorium as a benefit for KZYX and Z, the Alliance for Democracy, and the Fort Bragg High School Drama Club, Sunday, July 27th. More information at 937-1113 or kzyx.org.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that, and I hope that you'll have an opportunity to look out for that benefit. Now, tomorrow morning, there will be at 9 o'clock. There should be a great show. I do not have anything on my sheet here about what's going on at 9 o'clock, but it'll be community events, and you'll want to check that. And then it should be something on corporations and democracy tomorrow at 1 as well, and so you'll want to check that out on KZYXNZ. Also, you should know that coming up after Earth and Sky at 8 o'clock is going to be Reality Check. And then after that, Dead Air with Muerto Buerto this evening, and I'm sure that you'll enjoy that as well. I want you to know that if I want to thank the producers of this show, the Hermeneutic Institute for Holistic Health and Education, and this show and all the shows that you hear on Education Now can be heard and downloaded for free at www.pacificsites.com/TildaHermes. And my contact information, of course, is hermes@pacific.net. I especially want to thank board member Christopher Melville for turning me on to Kathy Morris, which was such a treat for me. I also want you to know that next month on Education Now, August 21st, my guest will be Jacqueline Reeves Pippin, Director of Development at the National Association of Biology Teachers, and our focus will be science. So I hope you'll check into that. I want to ask you to check out the Scientific America that came out on July 5th. This is a follow-up for last month's show on music. The July 5th issue of Scientific America is on dance and body language, so check that out. It's really amazing what they're discovering with a mind-brain connection and the and dance and movement and body language. Just wonderful, so do check that out. So good night now, and thank you so much for listening. This is KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits and Ukiah, and 88.1 FM Fort Bragg, also KZYX.org on the World Wide Web, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting, listener-supported community radio, and we're going to go now to Earth and Sky. Thank you, everyone.